The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. The term artificial intelligence was coined in 1956. That year, an AI proof of concept, a program called Logic Theorist, was developed by Alan Newell, Cliff Shaw, and Herbert Simon, and presented at the Dartmouth Summer Research Project on Artificial Intelligence, hosted by John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky. Minsky and McCarthy, both later recognized as fathers of AI, described artificial intelligence as any task performed by a machine that would have previously been considered to require human intelligence. So far, though, no software or entity comprised of software and hardware has in fact exhibited human-level intelligence and cognition. Most of what is labeled AI today is in fact a subsection of AI called machine learning. Machine learning, or ML, is attributed as a natural outgrowth of the intersection of computer science and statistics. If the defining question of computer science is a given problem solvable, and if so, how do we build a machine to solve it? And if the defining question of statistics is, what can we deduce or infer from a set of data and a set of modeling assumptions, and with what reliability, then machine learning builds on both and focuses on the question of how to get computers to program themselves from an initial structure and then experience, and incorporate additional computational architectures and algorithms that can better capture, store, index, retrieve, and merge these data, and how to orchestrate learning subtasks into a larger system. Yet even this is a very simplistic definition. Merely thinking about machine learning in such stark outlines misses the question of how we can build systems so they can deliver positive results while avoiding unintended negative consequences. Perhaps we ought to think about machine learning as a new discipline in engineering, one that incorporates fields as varied as economics, humanities, and social sciences. Maybe then, with this new construct in mind, we can develop machine learning systems that are attentive to social welfare, create new economic markets, and solve large-scale problems that enhance human life.
Michael I. Jordan is the Pihong Chen Distinguished Professor in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science and the Department of Statistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He received his master's in mathematics from Arizona State University and earned his PhD in cognitive science in 1985 from the University of California, San Diego. He was a professor at MIT from 1988 to 1998. Professor Jordan is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, a member of the National Academy of Engineering, and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He has been named a Neyman Lecturer and a Medallion Lecturer by the Institute of Mathematical Statistics. Professor Jordan was a plenary lecturer at the International Congress of Mathematicians in 2018. He received the Ulf Grenander Prize from the American Mathematical Society in 2021, the IEEE John von Neumann Medal in 2020, the ITCHCHI Research Excellence Award in 2016, the David E. Brimblehart Prize in 2015, and the ACM AAAI Alan Newell Award in 2009. He is a fellow of the AAAI, ACM, ASA, CSS, IEEE, IMS, ISBA, and SIAM. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
So let's start with some definitions. First, in addition to what Alexa said in the intro, what is machine learning? What is AI? Why are they confused with one another so often?
I'll be happy to try to give you some definitions, but I must say I don't really like definitions, and I don't think we tend to operate with definitions in mind. I think there are intellectual trends that reflect our era. And I like to think of our era as lasting like a century. That's kind of the intellectual era we're living in. And the last century has been full of new developments. Information sciences, broadly speaking, computer science, the growth of statistics, economic science arose in this era. And this had huge implications for human beings. We're now living with these kind of ideas in our midst. And control systems of all sorts. And so the growth of a whole branch of information technology is kind of the phenomenon. Perhaps the most striking change in our last, say, 10 or 20 years is the magnitude of it, the growth and scale of data, the availability of data in all areas of human inquiry and discourse, sciences, technology, and the granularity of it. There's now data about, each individual human. There's data about each individual gene in the genome, about each region of the sky. And that's qualitatively different than previous eras, even though some of the ideas and thinking were the same. The scale of it and the specificity of it, the scope of the inquiry has now shifted. But I think of our era as that. And the implications for systems, indeed, I really liked the introduction. It's less about a specific computer or how an entity that's intelligent behaves. And it's more about the overall system that we're all part of, which may be planetary in scale, the system that underlies finance, the system that underlies worldwide commerce, health, transportation. These systems have computers and data and flows and people involved in helping with decision making. And I think that's the right scale and scope to think about in our era. And the trends behind that are definitely not just AI, of the notion that you'd put intelligence and thought into a computer. It's operations research, it's control theory, it's economics, it's certainly statistics, and computing kind of as an infrastructure lying behind all of that. And it's also the human experience of living with all of this, being in the midst of computing and developing understanding of that, developing legal structures to think about it. And so that all that big phenomenon is certainly not subsumed within the field of AI. AI, I still think of as an intellectual aspiration. It's almost a philosophical one. It's thinking about what would it be like if a computer could really think like us, reason, plan, and so on. And I still think it's an interesting, absolutely fascinating philosophical aspiration. It just hasn't happened yet. It's not even clear what the glimmer is that's going to sort of start to make it happen. But in the meantime, computers can do things that are, striking and in some sense intelligent. I mean, a computer can compute the digits of pi. I can't do that. So is the computer more intelligent than me? Well, for some narrow kind of task, for sure. And that's what we want. It can calculate things that we could never calculate. But that doesn't somehow mean that we've been surpassed in intelligence. It just means we have kind of a new tool in the universe. So machine learning itself is a terminology that I'm only partially, I'm a little more fond of. As the introduction alluded to, it's kind of a merger of statistical or inferential thinking with computing. But the seeds of that have been present for a couple hundred years. Gauss, the original statistician, if you will, or one of the original ones who was doing astronomy with the kind of methods we use today and doing it on, with computing of the day. Would recognize what we're doing now, so it's conceptually not all that different.
But yet I get the feeling that part of what you're saying is that a difference in, as a friend of mine used to like to say, a difference in number can mean a difference in kind. I mean, while yes. Johannes Kepler would recognize that this is the study of where the stars are in the sky, what's available by way of data and therefore the inferences that can be drawn are really a whole other world.
Something qualitatively has changed. It's not clear, though, that conceptually, really, we're using gradient descent methods and we're using large amounts of data to find patterns. And again, our forebears, the Gausses of the world would recognize all of that. But I think this thing I tried to get at about the specificity, that it's granular data. So it used to be that, if you're a physicist, you'd study data about, the motion of objects, and there's the laws, F equals MA, that would characterize all objects. And that was the goal of science. And now you have motions of particular kinds of objects and particular kinds of situations, and you want to have specific laws. And that's even way more true about human beings. The idea that you would have a single law for all humans seems a little kind of outdated almost, but there was not data to do anything different. Now there's data about humans in all kinds of situations, including commercial ones and social ones of all kinds. And you can start to actually do a little science at that level of something more specific. So I'd argue that's actually what's changed, that it's qualitatively different in that it's now specific and granular. And that's kind of the kind of inferences. And if you're a business, of course, you're trying to do personalization. That's one of the core ideas in business. And that reflects the fact that I'm not going to just build one business for everybody. I'm going to do it different from different people. I make more money doing that. So that's also, if you will, qualitatively different. But definitely do not think of AI as having come up with great ideas or machine learning that were qualitatively, breakthroughs. I don't think that's happened, and that's changed everything. It's rather the accumulation of scale and scope, as you're talking about, together with some pretty good ideas, have unleashed some things. And I do believe in 100 years, we'll look back and there will have been some qualitative conceptual breakthroughs. I just don't know what they are.
Speaking of scale, you yourself have pointed out that advances in machine learning have powered innovative products and services from companies like Google, Netflix, Amazon, and others. You could argue that machine learning is fundamental to their business model. As you just said, there's so much data and also so much of it is just so granular. But have those advantages now given an unfair advantage to these big companies, the big tech, because they consume so much data?
Yeah, it's a great question. My answer is going to be no, in a maybe slightly surprising way. First of all, I really want to distinguish between an Amazon business model, or maybe Alibaba in China to make this a little more international, and the Google business model and Facebook. Their business model fundamentally is about advertising. That's how they make their money. Right. And that goes back to, when television arose, it needed to be free. You didn't want people to pay for it. So you had to think of a way to monetize it. You did that with advertising. And so Google
and Alibaba you're talking about.
No. Google and not Alibaba. So Google and Facebook. Just specialize a little bit more. Free services, and you got to make money somehow. And so surprisingly, you can kind of corner the market on advertising. So in that sense, it's unfair. If your advertisers out there dominated, it's unfair to them. But I guess I don't care so much. But, Amazon and then Alibaba in China, they bring packages to people's door, right? And that's a whole different kind of business model, a whole different kind of service. Mm-hmm. Now, whether it's more healthy to human beings, you can argue. I mean, bringing search boxes and information is useful to people. But when you're really bringing packages to people's door, you're doing something economics. You've got something that people are willing to pay for a little bit, right? And you're now in the kind of the world of providing a real business model. And all the things that come with that, you create markets, you create links between producers and consumers, data flows on the basis of that. You create computing infrastructure to support all of that. Data flows on the basis of that. And I think of that as a much more natural kind of business model and flow. And to scale that and to make it viable and successful and safe and useful, you got to do all kinds of machine learning under the hood. So in particular, you've got to model fraud. If people are putting their credit cards into an e-commerce site, you got to make sure that you know what's fraud and what's not. You got to model supply chains, because if you're serving a billion products to hundreds of millions of people, which is in fact what these companies are doing, you got to know where all the products are in the supply chain at all moments. And that's now unbelievably scaled, relative to what companies used to do. So those companies had to gather all that data and make all those models and build all those infrastructures to be able to do e-commerce at that scale. Now, do they have an unfair advantage for e-commerce? Well, no, they have an advantage, but it's fair. They built it, they did it, and they're bringing value to people. Does that also give them an unfair advantage for things like natural language processing or things that like academics might want to work on in other domains because you just have all this data?
Yeah.
No. I don't believe so. If I want to build a system that does, medical predictions or does something, some other business model having to do with, social interactions among people or whatever, I got to collect that data myself. And maybe the company has some head start, but rarely is their data granular enough for the phenomena I care about in my little business model or my little piece of science. So actually, I think it's actually quite surprising that the companies don't have data for a lot of the new ideas or science ideas or business models that, there's plenty of room and niche for smaller companies to emerge, but also for academics to do all kinds of research here. And I don't think that has changed. In fact, what Google started to do at some point is they have so much language data, they provided things like, a natural language service, if you will, that does translation, and they make it free and they advertise against it. So it's not even yet a business model. But now that becomes a commodity. If I'm doing natural language, I can build on top of that and then do more. And so it's no longer a natural advantage for them in terms of any kind of business model.
And it strikes me that a lot of the tension in the space around AI, and I use that term intentionally, and these questions is the sense that somehow somebody's getting ahead of where we are for some value of we. So whether it's an unfair advantage because there's an irreproducible large granular set of data, or whether it's, you know, I don't understand what this how this analysis is done, you know, whether it's computing the digits of pi, or which we do know how to do, but there's this sense of, if I can't touch it, smell it, feel it, or build it myself, then is that a problem? And I think that's where we're seeing some of the tension around fear of AI that has been expressed by a number of sort of leading figures in industry. And maybe goes a little bit to the heart of, is it an unfair advantage?
There's too much packed in there. I'm going to disagree with about half of that. The fear of AI that expressed by some figures, I think you mean like Elon Musk or whatever. Mm. Hey, well, and I don't know when an AI believes that stuff. Just, you know, and Elon, genius of our time and so on, but doesn't know much about AI and thinks that it's thought in computers and we should interface to the brain and has all these crazy ideas about it. Fun, crazy stuff, but science fiction for hundreds of years. So let's discount that. You know, fear of AI. Well, we have fear of, individual humans have fear of all kinds of things, including vaccines, including, I think all kinds of things out of our control, right? And so, we could talk about that, but I don't think that's really what the fear is. Fear of monopoly, that's not a fear. That's part of, economic systems, and we have to have regulations of government. We have to have discourse about that. But that has nothing to do with Elon Musk's fear of AI. Some companies have advantages because of discoveries in AI that they kind of hold and then they can exploit, right? And I'm going to argue very much no, because AI is still mostly done, and I'm using the term AI again just to kind of help out with the discussion, but the development of the algorithms and the infrastructure and all that is all done completely openly. All the work is mostly done still in academia, and some of it's done in some of the big labs. It's all in the archive within a day. It's all out there. There are no papers held back, right? And it's all pretty simple stuff. This is not super advanced, mathematics. It's pretty easy stuff. And you go all around the world, which I do, and the 25-year-olds there have read all those papers. And they know it just as well as any researcher inside of Google, I can guarantee you, right?
So that's an important point.
But what else does Google have? Well, they have large numbers of computers. So they can do some kind of show-off things like AlphaGo or something, which others maybe can't do as easily. But I can get tons of computers just by paying Amazon a little bit and using the cloud, right? It's not, and that's true in many countries. So I really, currently, this may change, but there are no conceptual advantages held by the companies. And then there might be market position advantages, but that's classical. Standard Oil had that, and that has to be think about in economic terms.
Yeah, I think my point was that not that these were necessarily valid positions, and what you've described is really how they aren't, how there isn't an intelligence that's scary and worthy of fear, but that this is where people's fears come from. So people who are not in AI, who are not in machine mm-hmm. learning, who don't understand pattern recognition from, today or 100 years ago, it does potentially stand up a situation where you don't recognize it, so therefore it's fearful, it's something worthy of fear.
So the psychology of human fear, is real, and I have it too, and like I alluded to, and I think it's real and meaningful, and certainly I would not claim that one should not have fear of the future and fear of technology. Moreover, another element in what you were getting at that I do agree with is transparency issues. So if I go to the bank and want to get a loan, and the bank says no, I don't want they just have them point to an algorithm and say the algorithm decided.
Right. That's no good. Black box.
That's not because something that I don't think that's about fear. That's about the legal system, and that's about our recourse as human beings and about what we expect and naturally and should have. And if the algorithm is not doing that, well, the algorithm is messed up, and that's an engineering and a technical problem to work on. And I personally believe there's been a bit too much optimism on, by a lot of the AI colleagues saying AI just solves all these problems. It can do better predictions than anybody. Therefore, let's just use it. It'll only help humanity. I think that's just dead wrong because humanity needs transparency. They need to understand their decisions. They need to have it all embedded in a legal system and embedded in a social contract and compact. I think it's going to take decades to kind of make machine learning and algorithms emerge well with our social compact. I think it is a development of a whole new branch of engineering to do that. And I don't like the naivete that somehow AI just solves the problems magically. Mm. It is a complicated, useful tool. And you've got to include it as a tool and think about it very, very deeply. And I don't think there's maybe been a branch of engineering that ever emerged that was quite as complex as this. Chemical engineering is one I tend to refer to. You know, the idea of doing chemicals at scale was complicated and it was going to have a huge impact and people were excited, right? But it didn't have humans quite as much in the mix as this has. So this is complicated.
So speaking of branches of engineering, in reading your bio and doing some research about you, it struck me that you are the Michael Jordan of ML, and I, you know, pun intended, you are the foremost authority in the world on ML. You have, in your writings, you've said that we have a major challenge in our hands, bringing together computers and humans in a way that can enhance human life. And you've argued that this really is a new branch of engineering that builds on various other branches and disciplines like statistics, like social sciences, economics, humanities, et cetera. And you've argued that this should be taught as a new way, a new engineering concept in schools. Can you talk a little bit about why, you know, statistics and computing and data science all make sense? Why are disciplines like economics and humanities sort of in the mix and the consideration? And what kinds of conceptual flaws would we be subject to if we ignored the importance of, say, economics or psychology?
Okay, yeah, thanks. That's a fantastic question. That's the one I hope will kind of continue to be asked for the coming decades, because that really gets at the heart of this. First of all, the word engineering has kind of been deprecated, it's accrued a certain bad smell over the years. If you say social science, that sounds great. You know, if you say social engineering, that sounds terrible. Mm-hmm. If you say genome science, that sounds wonderful. Genome engineering has.
It is.
Even like mathematics, mathematics stands all by itself, but people talk about the mathematical sciences. That sounds great.
Or bioengineering.
Engineering doesn't sound any good. Mm-hmm. And so on. I could keep on going. Maybe there's something to that, but think about how much engineering has done for human beings, you know, arguably more than any in the sciences. Like civil engineering gave us our bridges and our buildings chemical engineering, gave us all the materials we have, including all the drugs and medicines that we have. And electrical engineering, obviously. And so in terms of human happiness, engineering is arguably contributed more than anything else, right? So how come the term has gotten deprecated? I think it's partly just because there's these externalities, these other things that happen that people didn't think about. And so that's why I'm very eager. I think we are developing engineering here. It's real world systems that you deploy with compute, and they do things in the real world, like, healthcare and, transportation and financial kind of things. And they are supposed to bring value to human beings. They're supposed to work and they're supposed to be robust and all that. There's scientific understanding behind it, just like there was for chemical engineering and electrical engineering. And so, but it's really about the system. It's really about it working and doing good things for good for people. And so we got to think through all the implications of, is it really going to work? Is it really going to have good place? And that's an engineering style of thinking. And so I want to bring in younger students and teach them that they can think through these things themselves. And they often, some of them want to just do pure science and write down, laws, but some of them want to change things in the world. They want to build better structures, for healthcare, for social justice, for whatever they want. They have their own problems and they got to think them through in an engineering kind of way. Right. And so part of when you have humans in the mix, engineering kind of way has to have economics and humanities in it, because it's not just about data. It's about values. It's about what do you want? What does humans want? What do groups of humans want? How do we make sure that people protect?
That's really critical. I mean, this is the argument that's really come into discussion lately from a number of different angles. And I was very interested when I read that this is what you were advocating. And this is sort of the why. You're asking not just the what. What can we make? How can we make it? But sort of the why, to what end? And what are the values that underlie it?
That's right. I don't have the values that I want to impose on the systems, nor do I think Mark Zuckerberg does, or Joe Biden. I think it has to emerge from down below. People should be able to express their values and have them be recognized and then brought in and respected as part of the systems. And, you know, to a large extent, that's what economists try to do, right? And of course, their field is still in development. And I think it's going to change greatly in the next 100 years. It's going to have to be a whole new kind of economics that has data and, you know, these more, you know, granular level interactions and so on. I think a lot of them recognize that. So I got interested in this partly just by thinking about congestion. You know, if machine learning systems are doing decision making, like, you know, trying to help you to figure out the fastest path to the airport, you know, it's a dumb, obvious thing that a machine learning system could help you do. It's got lots of data, you know, it finds that. And if it's just working for me, then it's going to do a great job. But if it's working for everybody in the city, it may send everybody down the same road because it looks like the fastest road. Now we've created congestion and it's no longer the fastest road. All right. So what do you do at that point? Well, if you're kind of a classical IT person, like Facebook kind of style, I think you would try to say, well, we know a lot about these humans. We know their browsing history. We've collected lots of data about them. We know who wants to go on what road. Now, this is an exaggeration, but that's kind of the spirit, is that we personalize. We know that you, Alexa, want to go down that road because we just know you pretty well. And we know that, Leslie, you want to go down that road. And we figure out how to balance the traffic and make sure it all flows. All right. And I hope you kind of see the ridiculousness as kind of on economics. The smarter thing to do would be to create an economy, a market, where you, Alexa, are kind of told in that moment in some way that there's possible congestion, that if you want to save your money, you could go on a slightly slower route and, you know, save the money for some other day. And you, Leslie, may be in a big hurry today and you may want to spend your extra money. When I say money, I mean, you know, some currency. And when I say, you know, decide, I mean, there might be a little, you know, agent working on your behalf to try to help this whole kind of, you know,
this becomes really for self-driving cars. This is a real issue for self-driving cars, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's not just self-driving cars. It is certainly about self-driving cars, but it's just about cars. It's about getting bodies from one place to another. And again, it's about the values you have. You know, what are you, and it's value. Maybe this is a dumb example of value, how much of a hurry I'm in to go.
Yeah, but that's an economic value.
At the moment, it's an economic value. It matters to me to keep my children or I've got to go to the hospital. It matters to me a lot in that moment, perhaps. And I don't even know that before the moment occurs. So it couldn't have been learned in the data, right? It couldn't be just a machine learning system. It's got to be thought through in the moment that I'm plumped into a situation. And that's what economics is about, kind of in the market, in the moment, things occur and then you react. And the intelligence of the market makes something somehow, ideally, better. And that style of thinking has just not been present in machine learning or certainly AI. And that to me is a huge defect of the whole in the field.
And is that related to the notion of needing to be able to bring different systems of machine learning together to interact with each other? Because I mean, the self-driving car is an example of there are multiple different specialized systems analyzing a lot of data at the same time. How do you bring that together in a coordinated fashion?
It's partly related to that. I mean, that's just kind of classical engineering, that systems have components and you got to bring them together so it all kind of works well. But, you know, economics is also about scarcity and conflict, right? That there's not enough road space to go down. And there's Or preference. And it's also about building connections between producers and consumers. And so the other kind of thing that helped me to think this through a bit, other than just things like traffic or whatever, is think about domains like music or the arts or even journalism, right? There's a producer and there's a consumer, right? And you really want to set up a link between them, that the kind of the producer is producing for a certain set of consumers and the consumers know how to find the producer. And because something valuable is passing between them, say a song is being listened to and it's a song that someone loves, that value should be reflected in some sense economically. So I like thinking about like a system that doesn't just stream music to people and then advertises to make money for the people doing the streaming, rather a system that reveals to the artist, here's the people that are listening to me and lets me reach out and say, hey, I'll come play your wedding or hey, do you like this song? And does that at scale and creates a whole market of producer-consumer relationships using all of our technology, our machine learning and our data and all that. And the platform disappears at that point. It doesn't have to do advertising. It just makes connections and some money starts to flow because it's real value. Just like I was alluding to Amazon earlier, you know, sends packages from people and say they'll pay for it. There's real money there. And then you can just, you know, the musician gets most of that money perhaps. And the platform takes 5% instead of taking all of the money, which is what's currently happening.
Hmm.
That starts to say, okay, how can I build a system like that? Is it enough just to analyze the data and put it out there, you know, and build a, you know, on the cloud? No, I got to have economics principles. Otherwise, this is going to be gamed. It's not going to work, you know, and so on. So I got to go to my economics books or my colleagues and say, how do we build a system that has got, you know, principles, and they're all learning from each other. And as Leslie alluded to, there's got to now be cooperation. Like, you know, if we're trying to learn about another example is like recommendations for restaurants, right? I can't experience all restaurants and decide which ones I prefer. But you experience some, I experience some, we start to recommend to each other. And then the restaurants are also trying to connect up and build platforms that actually then allow that kind of information to be shared. That's economics meets machine learning.
That's really excellent. And while we've covered a lot of ground, I feel like there's so much more that we could delve into, but sadly we're just about out of time. So I will wrap up by asking you, what are three key things that you think we the general populace need to keep in mind as we face this brave new world with more machine learning?
Ooh, okay. Yeah, I'm not going to be pretty good. I'll try. That's a great hard question. I think that we're living in a really tough time, and we're all kind of trying to ignore the fact that there's so much misinformation and there's so much distrust, and it's really the worst of times in some ways. The pandemic sort of amplified it, but in some ways almost not. It made us retreat into our homes for a while. But that fact is serious. And I think computer science has had a role to play in that. So I think the general populace has got to kind of push back on that. They ask technologists to do better. It's got to be, you know, willing to insist that it not be this way, not just wait for it to happen. You know, education is still critical. I think that we nearly had fascism in the United States in the last 2 years, just to bring up something kind of.
We did.
And I think there's two ways that we escape fascism, and it's not over, done deal yet. Number one was the rule of law did prevail. The judges made good decisions, and those judges are often were Republican, you know, judges, but they still had the rule of law in their brains. And why? Well, they were educated in the American system, including the universities, and they're part of that. That was one part of it. The other part of it is that we are a diverse country. And I think that, you know, the Black people in the South, just to really be clear about it, really rose up and really said, you know, we're participating and we have a voice and we're going to make these things happen. And I think that helped us escape fascism, that they were smart enough to see fascism and realize they didn't want it. Right. And so culture and rule of law is something the United States has done pretty well. And so, those were endangered. And so I think that people have to focus on those strengths and ask, you know, technology, not just to bring us miracles and, you know, and expect for vast wealth and all that, but rather that it merges well with culture and it merges well with rule of law, because that's the way we're going to continue to build a decent society going forward. So hopefully that was helpful. That would give you three things, but hopefully that was helpful.
That was excellent. Great. Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.